We welcome then our next speaker, who is Cal Poe, speaking on the Reformation and the rise of modern science.
There's a large crowd here this afternoon than I expected, so I did not bring enough papers for everyone. If you'd like a copy of the paper, I would be happy to send it to you by email if you give me your email address after the meeting. A matter of continuing curiosity concerns why modern science emerged in Northern Europe instead of in a region that had a longer or more developed intellectual tradition, such as the Indus River Valley, the Yalu River Valley, the Nile River Valley, or the Tigris and Euphrates Basin. China, India, and the Islamic world made remarkable discoveries about the physical world and the world of mathematics when Northern Europe was still semi-barbaric. Let me take the semi off of that. Yet Northern Europe made sudden and dramatic gains in scientific knowledge beginning in the 16th century. While the other cultures had the intellect of science, they lacked one ingredient that came from an unlikely source, as the modern world would count likely sources for scientific discovery. They never experienced anything comparable to the Reformation, which rejected tradition. And that's my main concern in this paper, the whole idea of the rejection of tradition within a culture. In his discussion of the rise of modern science, Alfred North Whitehead dismissed the Protestant Reformation as a, quote, domestic affair and a, quote, popular uprising that, quote, drenched Europe in blood. He manages to think of modern science as somehow unrelated to religion when modern science is the product of religion, and more specifically, it is the product of a heated debate within the Christian community of learning in the West. In the Reformation, the principal issue at stake was one of pathology. In the 16th century, the science faculty did not observe with detached amusement the discussions of the theology faculty. The science faculty was the theology faculty. The university was a monastic community. All disciplines were subdisciplines of theology. Theology was the queen of the sciences, and philosophy was her handmaid. Protestant Reformation was not only a debate about authority in matters of religion, but also authority in politics and all areas of scholarship, including what we now call science. The change of mind that we call the Reformation began to take place at least 150 years before Luther's posting of the 95 Theses, and it would continue to unfold 150 years afterwards. Rather than the product of the later Renaissance, as Whitehead suggests, this way of conceiving authority had begun at least by the time of John Wycliffe, who died in 1384, long before the observations of Copernicus, who died in 1543. One might even argue that it played a large part in the thought of William of Ockham, who died in 1349. Ockham repudiated the philosophical theology of the scholastic tradition. He regarded natural theology as an impossible project and insisted on scripture as the ultimate authority in religion. He ascribed to it an authority above pope or ecclesiastical hierarchy. The interpretation of scripture belonged not to the clergy only, but also, quote, to the discretion and counsel of the wisest men, sincerely zealous for justice, without respect to persons, if such can be found, whether they be poor or rich, subjects or rulers, end quote. Wilson Walker observed that in his contest with what he deemed a derelict papacy, he taught that scripture and not the decisions of councils and popes is alone binding on the Christian. No wonder that Luther, in this respect, could call him dear master. Ockham did not create a new way of thinking. He merely modified a growing intellectual stream of thought that reached back even earlier in the medieval period. We find this isolated individual. And what I would suggest is that it takes a while for something to become a movement or a trend, or to capture a large enough body of people that you can call it a scientific revolution. They have isolated things going on. Something finally has to happen. I think you probably had isolated individuals in China or India or Persia who would make these isolated observations. But something has to finally coalesce. And that's what was very slowly happening over a period of centuries. The medieval world built upon the Augustinian tradition that looked to Plato, and the later Middle Ages on the Thomist tradition that looked to Aristotle. Both Plato and Aristotle differed greatly over the reliability of sensory observation of the world of experience. They both appealed in some way to universal forms and how the physical world relates to them. The great revolution in thought came with the nominalists, who argued that universal forms had no existence other than as names for the things in the world of experience. In contrast to the nominalists, the realists affirmed that the universals exist. In the 12th century debate over transubstantiation, the nominalists lost, and transubstantiation was declared dogma by the Fourth Lateran Council in 1215. Now that had been a discussion that had been going on since the time of Charlemagne. So centuries this debate goes on. When Lamont appropriated nominalism, you have to be careful of exactly what he's doing. He's trying to make it fit within the limits of church dogma. Here's the suspicion of the eternal holiness. By the time of Wycliffe, a great schism divided the Church of Rome with multiple popes and intricate political machinations between popes, kings, and emperor. It was a time during which religious orders grew wealthy in the accumulation of lands. I won't take time to read all this talk, but this was a time of growing disorder in the Church. You had the Babylonian captivity of the Church in France. You then had three popes. So it was a bit of a scandalous time. The translation of the Bible into vernacular, which Wycliffe inspired, came about because of the place that Scripture held in Wycliffe's theology. While Wycliffe's controversial teachings addressed the abuses and corruption of the Church and its place in society, the basis for his teachings all went back to the Bible as his authority. Wycliffe insisted that faith depends on the Scriptures and that to ignore the Scripture is to ignore Christ. Wycliffe respected the doctrines of the Church and utilized their arguments for support, particularly the arguments of Augustine. Nevertheless, he never placed the tradition of the Church on the same level of the authority of Scripture. Rather than the Pope and tradition, Wycliffe looked to Christ as the head of the Church. And it's particularly important to note that Wycliffe used the category of law when speaking of the Bible, rather than one of the philosophical terms associated with the philosophical tradition of medieval theology. There was a different vocabulary that you could have drawn on. He was drawing upon this idea of law. Herbert Wynne, editor of Wycliffe's works, argued that Wycliffe's understanding of Scripture formulated the great Protestant ideal of freedom from authority and validity of private judgment. That Wycliffe was part of the stream of thought. He influenced quotes in England. If you look at maps of where Wycliffe and his Lollards were active, and then maps of where the Puritans would be active 150 years later, and they're the same places. So it's intriguing. One of his disciples, John Huss, carried his tradition with him to Prague, he was condemned by the Council of Constance, burned at the stake, good measure. Council ordered that Wycliffe's bones be exhumed from his grave and burned as well. As for the Bible, the council decided that it was too dangerous for the common folk, and it was restricted to use by the clergy. Once out in the open, however, the idea that tradition might somehow inhibit one's grasp of the truth had become firmly planted in the consciousness of the church, even if only as an idea to condemn. Wycliffe and Huss did not merely reject tradition, they insisted upon going to a reliable source for truth. They insisted upon going to the primary source rather than tradition about that source. According to Darby Sayers, quote, it was the rise of the new learning which led eventually to the Reformation, to the Renaissance, and to the invention of the scientific method. Sayers argued that the old world fell apart because the professionals who ran the old world grew lazy in their habits and old-fashioned in their ideas. In other words, they were bound by the traditions of which they were inextricably a part. Rather than the professional leadership of the church, Sayers says it was certain amateur thinkers who hit upon that new method of thought which we now call scientific. By which we mean the method that collects facts by observation, uses them to form a theory, and then tests the theory by fresh experiments with facts. Sayers viewed the explosion of knowledge in astronomy and physics as a piece with the new notions of art and literature that accompanied the new way of thinking about religion. The Renaissance in art nearly swept aside the accumulated medieval tradition as new thinking in theology had swept aside the accumulated tradition of the church in favor of an older, more authentic, and reliable source. The arts found their older source in the ancient world in which Christ was born. When Martin Luther raised the issue of authority in 1517, he operated out of the conviction that tradition could not lead to ultimate truth and salvation. He believed in the priority of Scripture as his ultimate authority. As a professor of Old Testament, Luther developed his theology from an examination of the Bible rather than through the scholastic method of philosophical categories that had dominated in the church for centuries. In particular, Luther rejected the authority of Aristotelian philosophy in the interpretation of the Bible. That's all of us have to do with science. Now, the rise of modern science. The work of Francis Bacon, Bacon died in 1626, in developing what we now call a scientific method, immersed in the context of the working out of the English Reformation. The Puritans hoped to carry the English Reformation farther than Henry VIII had been willing to go. The concerns of the Puritans coincided with the method of Bacon. First, like the earlier reformers, they proposed to eliminate the traditions of the English church, whether in theology or ceremony. Second, they proposed to introduce a preaching ministry to England that spoke plainly, rather than in the literary style that had prevailed for centuries. For 1,000 years, preaching meant allegory. Preaching was all about metaphor. Puritans wanted it concrete and factual. Third, they intended to discover God's laws for the governance of his church as laid down in Scripture. This was the object of the Westminster Assembly of Divines during the English Civil War. How do we determine if there is a law for the governance of God's church? And if so, what is it? The proposal Bacon made for scientific research involved nothing less than a rejection of the received philosophical tradition as the determinative starting point for understanding the physical world. Though Aristotle's philosophy had been the catalyst for engaging the physical world during the High Middle Ages, by the time of Bacon, it had become straitjacket. Just as the reformers had insisted on going to the Bible as God's revealed word for its authority, Bacon insisted on going to creation as God's handiwork to understand the physical order. The Puritans and their theological forebears had rejected the authority of tradition and insisted upon immediate examination of the written text. Bacon rejected the authority of philosophical tradition and insisted upon the immediate examination of the observable data. The purpose of the scientific method was not to protect scientific inquiry from the assumption that God had made everything. Rather, the purpose of the scientific method was to protect science from the speculative philosophical systems that explain the world rationalistically by theory without recourse to examination, experimentation. The philosophical explanations, instead of the God hypothesis, hampered science in understanding how the world works. Bacon was laboring to figure out why the West discovered so little about the world of 1,000 years. Why was there such an impoverishment of scientific understanding? And this was his conclusion. Our philosophy is holding us back. The most famous case of this sort occurred with Galileo. We've heard that discussed. We're pretty familiar with it. Remember, Galileo ran afoul of the academic authorities because his experiments conflicted with what Aristotle said the smooth spheres and globes of heaven were supposed to be like. But remember the location where this took place. Galileo lived in Florence. And remember, just a couple of decades earlier, Savonarola had led his revolution there in Florence, picked up the Medici, and then waiting for the return of Christ, this rejection of church tradition was a dangerous thing in that part of Italy, that time of history. The great advance in scientific knowledge began with Francis Bacon's argument that the acquisition of knowledge cannot blossom through the reliance on ancient philosophy or tradition. Instead, scientific method involved experimentation through trial and error. His initial thoughts on what is come to be known as the scientific method were published as Novum Organum in 1620. The Novum Organum, or the New Organon, was a takeoff on Aristotle's treatise on rational thinking entitled Organon. Bacon proposed replacing Aristotle's method of deductive reasoning from unquestionably true premises with a new method of inductive reasoning based on the raw evidence found in nature. Bacon's method proceeds through a process of elimination rather than from an axiom of affirmation. He explained that if the mind attempts to do this affirmatively from the beginning, as it always does if left to itself, fancies will arise and conjectures and purely defined notions and axioms needing daily correction, unless one chooses, in the manner of a schoolman, to defend the indefensible. So that was his attitude about what he'd been doing now. In his discussion, Bacon distinguished between the metaphysics of the philosopher and the physics of the scientist. Metaphysics deals with the eternal world of forms and final causes, while physics deals with efficient and material causes. Bacon regarded final cause as unhelpful in understanding the actual operation of the physical world, and tends to distort science. Bacon believed that, quote, the task and purpose of human science is to find for a given nature its form. By form, Bacon did not mean it. The old Greek philosophical conception of forms found in Aristotle that had preoccupied the school. Instead, he meant, quote, those laws and limitations of pure act which organize and constitute a simple nature, like heat, light, or weight, in every kind of susceptible material and subject. The form of heat, therefore, or the form of light, is the same thing as the law of heat, or the law of light. You know, this relates to the first paper we heard about Cartwright, this whole question, speaking of laws of nature. That whole terminology comes back to Bacon. In rejecting the old philosophical notion of science as related to the eternal form, Bacon chose the language of the reformers of the church from the time of Wycliffe. He proposed to discover the laws of nature. These were not the laws that have animalized material laid down. Rather, they were the laws that God laid down for the governance of the physical world. I make just a brief statement here about the context with the Puritan. Remember, he was a contemporary of the high Puritan movement, the authorization of translation of the scriptures by King James I. He was chancellor to James I. But there was also this change in attitude towards the English language, away from the poetic, toward the more concrete. Allegoric, very clean, probably the last great allegorical poem in English. 1596, I believe, yeah, 1596. About the same time, poor old Shakespeare had retired because he was old hat. He didn't want poetic plays. They wanted Betsy real plays. So his style of writing is fading away. We've seen the gradual death of poetry in the West since then. So it accelerated in the 20th century after World War I. But that's another piece of it. That's how this concern for the observable and factual begins to affect other parts of the culture. And this is the fascination that people have had with the scientific method. We've discussed science. We've discovered things about the world. And this is how I conclude this paper. So let me just talk through it rather than read it. No one grabbed hold of science more quickly than theologians. The theologians were not the last to embrace the scientific method. They were the first of the other disciplines to want to be scientific. And theologians wanted to be scientific because science was the real knowledge. And so, to be really true, you need your theology to be scientific. Both liberals and conservatives embrace this trend. The first one to really buy into it and popularize it was the Archbishop of Armagh, Archbishop Usher. You know his work on making the Bible scientific, developing the chronology for the Bible. Had great studying power. Scofield Reference Bible, published by Oxford University Press, still has data. I mean, but what most of us don't remember about Usher was he was the one who really began the critical examination of ancient texts. So he was trying to make biblical criticism scientific. We can go in the 19th century, Charles Finney was sure he had discovered the laws of the Bible. C.I. Schofield believed that he had discovered the scientific way to study the Bible. A.T. Robertson, one of the great Greek grammarians of the early 20th century, wanted his Greek grammar to be scientific. And so we have this tradition in which the scientific method did grow out of this general intellectual tradition that rejected tradition. And yet, What we have begun to see in the 20th century is a new philosophical metaphysic coming back into science. There's almost a need to have something to hold on to out there. And right now it looks like the great poser is naturalism, materialism, as this final call, this self-explanatory cause. But it is a metaphysical concept. It doesn't really have anything to do with science. Something that you bring into it from outside. It's a bit of what I think is going on in the heart of the lab. But we'll talk about that later on. Just one of many points. So, from the many discoveries that occurred within China, India, and the Islamic world, these rich cultures lack one element present within the Western Church at the beginning of the second They lack a mass intellectual movement that rejected tradition in the same way that the West experienced the Reformation. The intellectual movement that gave birth to the Reformation and the scientific revolution did not stand outside or alongside the Western Church. Instead, it grew up within the Western Church over a period of 500 years, with slight modifications in outlook over time until it came to full.
Give your thesis about the tech authority and that role that the mission played in the development of natural philosophy and natural science. Wouldn't it be simpler to simply point to the Renaissance humanism, which was shared by reformers, but not exclusively reformers, as the chief cause that you're aiming at? Because it's the Renaissance humanism that brings us the attention going back to primary sources. And another thing
let me deal with that.
Okay, sure. Yeah.
Because I think Sarah is right here, Renaissance humanism just didn't suddenly happen one day.
It is built on the same stream of intellectual development that has been going on for centuries. I'm not saying that Martin Luther and John Calvin produced the modern scientific method. I'm saying that this whole Reformation tradition, of which Calvin and Luther were a part, but which was really within the church, it's not that the Protestant church has produced it and the Catholics didn't. It's that the Western Christian tradition had this intellectual movement growing within it over a period of 500 years. Renaissance humanism was one of the offspring of it.
So you just the
Protestant Reformation was another offspring of it. The scientific revolution was another offspring of it. We could also say that democracy was an offspring.
So you wouldn't see Renaissance humanism as the trunk, with the Reformation being a branch. You would say there's something else, undescribable, which is the trunk of which these are both branches.
Yes.
Okay. Any other questions? I could keep going.
Yeah, I think the same thing, thinking a little bit before about that program, I'm a little bit nervous about the moral possible emphasis of the Reformation. What did that mean to deal with what the historiography sometimes calls continuity pieces?
I reject reduction, and I think it's a multifaceted dynamic. This is one of the pieces that's going on. We've heard two other papers today, and I would affirm both of those papers. That those are dynamics that were all going on. I think an example of the same tradition would be, three examples. It would be Galileo, Descartes, and Pascal, who were Catholic. Yes, they were within the Catholic Church. Bacon and his group had withdrawn from the Catholic Church,
but they were all part of this stream of thought that had been going on since the 10th, 11th century.
When you say what's the difference between what you're saying and what seems to be the trivial statement that says modern science is different from medieval science because the projection of stuff that was not modern science? Modern science is not Aristotelian, it's not qualitative, relative, and so forth. And therefore, it's different.
Well, I'm saying that it is different. There's an ingredient in the Western tradition that you do not find in the Islamic tradition. The Islamic tradition has never had a mass movement that rejected tradition. And so they have had other pieces. And so I'm just looking for what is a piece they did not have. I don't think this by itself explains everything, but this is one of those pieces that you find in the West that you don't find in China, where there were models against this sort of experimentation and stuff. You don't do that. Confucianism is veneration of tradition.
Right. Yes. Is there any precedent in Bacon or others in the period of Donald Kai's notion? Law of nature are a human invention and are descriptive rather than descriptive.
I don't think you find that in the
Bible. You do remind us
of it. But I don't see that in Bacon at all. But Bacon easily talks about God and God's involvement in law. I don't think it's necessarily one to call Bacon an orthodox Protestant of his time, but he certainly not going to avoid it.
Yeah. One question, you think your comment about philosophy being the root behind the rejection of Galileo. In part of Galileo's letter to Foster, the very first point Galileo makes is that the Copernican view rivals the consensus scripture. So you have to be a little bit careful with how philosophy and tradition both are used in the Galileo paradigm. So that's just kind of a caution.
Just following up on the previous line, if we are looking at complex causes, a variety of factors, does it even become meaningful anymore to talk about a stream of? Can we have a metanarrative, or do we just talk about a variety of causes?
Well, I think when you look at a culture over a period of centuries, and I think if you do look at cultures, you do have to think of them in long periods of time, that there are characteristics. It's always a moving target. Now, I agree with C.S. Lewis about that. You don't have neat divisions between the classical period and the medieval period and the modern period. It's always a moving target. But if you take large blocks of time, it is possible to describe general values that were held, general beliefs, practices, attitudes toward the world.
All right, one last question.
Where did the theory of killing, beheading people who didn't agree with you, that's not a good reputation for Christianity, and where did that come from?
Ah, that's a good old human tradition. We've been doing that thousands of years.
Not Christians, it's just people.
Oh, they've been doing the way to do that. You go back to Cain.
All right, well, join me in thanking all of our speakers today.